Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's edition of Risky Business is brought to you by Tenable Network Security and hosted, as always, by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting at greatly discounted rates. So thank you to Vigabyte for that. If your company is interested in becoming a Risky Business sponsor, please, by all means, email sponsorship@risky.biz. Now on to the show, and it's a great show this week because we've actually had some really beefy news down here in Australia. Australia's welfare agency, Centrelink, has written its own smart card authentication protocol, and it's released it to the public as a draft implementation. Now, the plan is to make it an ISO standard, and it's an extremely ambitious project when you think about it. Centrelink's smart card architect, Glenn Mitchell, will be along soon to talk about it. Centrelink has spent $500,000 of taxpayers' money on this so far. But apparently, the protocol has been reviewed by the Defence Signals Directorate, which is Australia's NSA equivalent, and NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology in the US. And apparently, both DSD and NIST have given it the tick. So it is very interesting stuff, and that's our feature this week. We'll also have a chat to Tenable Network Security's Marcus Ranham in this week's sponsor interview. We'll be talking about the recent hysteria around Chinese hackers apparently downloading the plans for America's Joint Strike Fighter. Terabytes of them or something. And my personal view is that someone would have noticed several terabytes of data leaking out over the wire, but hey, they must be right. That's coming up later. But first off, it's time for the news with our buddy Adam Metalstorm Boileau. And Adam, the first thing we're going to do on the news segment today is actually connect some dots that the world's press haven't managed to bring together, which is that the same guys who took over Domains, the Domains domain control panel in New Zealand and used it to deface Microsoft and Coca-Cola and all not. They've done the same thing in Puerto Rico.
They have indeed, yeah. The Stone H has got mirrors of their defacement in Puerto Rico. And yeah, same guy, same crew, same MO, some of the same sites like Coca-Cola.com.pr.
Yeah, and Microsoft as well.
Microsoft. What's interesting is they also did Google in Puerto Rico, which is pretty funny.
Yeah, so I mean, I just can't believe that nowhere in the story is it mentioned that a week prior, the exact same people had done the exact same thing to the exact same companies in New Zealand. Do you guys feel a little left out?
Well, we got our swine flu, man, so we're pretty good. We're good
on
the world stage and shit, man.
Well, that's a real infection, isn't it? You know, affecting affecting most hosts by the looks of things. Yikes. So maybe people should start shopping around for a more secure domain registrar because, you know, we're seeing a lot of defacements target, you know, where people are targeting domain registrar using some simple SQL injection bug to actually seize control of the control panel and then divert the sites elsewhere.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see who these guys hit next. You know, they're obviously rummaging through all the third world domain registries.
What, like New Zealand?
Yeah.
All right. Now, look, in this next piece, this actually came from Microsoft's blog. They're finally getting off their bum cheeks, and they're going to fix the auto-run feature of their product so that it doesn't allow things like Conficker to spread around anymore.
So they're going to fix the auto-run so it doesn't
auto-run.
yeah, I'm seeing a problem here. Another cool thing here is that, yes, okay, that's good, right? I guess they're going to make it a little more tricky, but the USB devices that emulate CD-ROM drives still work just fine.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that's what they're actually fixing here.
No, like it says further on down the article that U3 spec devices that emulate CD-ROM drives
shit, they're not
are still
going to
continue working as usual.
That's lame. That's really
yes,
lame.
Yes, it is.
But at least this will fix the auto runoff network share stuff, which is how Conficker wound up going buck wild in enterprise environments.
Yeah, no, so it does sound like they're making some improvements, and I mean, overall, Windows 7 does seem a bit less suck than Vista anyway, so that's all good. But yeah, you know, the U3 thing is still an issue.
Well, baby steps, Adam, baby steps. Now, there's been an interesting little bit of research posted on kernelbof.blogspot.com, so it's about a kernel buffer overflow, and it's really about how, you know, and I've often sort of spoken to people about this, and they've all said the same thing, which is when you see these kernel denial of service bugs, that should really read, remote exploitation bug in kernel, and that's what this guy's really proved here on this single blog posting. Am I reading this correctly?
Yes, yeah, no, you are, unfortunately. The you know, it's a classic example of, you know, bugs advertised as denial of service, you know, in the vendor, you know, the distribution advisories, and, you know, the Linux kernel maintainers also have a history of writing off security bugs as denial of service only when, you know, in reality they are, you know, exploitable by some, at least relatively talented person.
It seems that people really don't want to believe that kernel bugs are remotely exploitable. That's what I've noticed as well. People just say, oh, they're too hard to exploit, so therefore...
Well, I mean, in many cases they are hard to exploit, but that's not not a real barrier, right? It only takes one person to actually sit down, do the hard work, weaponize it, and then every, you know, all the other script kiddies can dot slash their way around the network. But no, you know, remote network stack kernel bugs, those are big deal stuff. And a bug like that, if you were selling it on the black market, would be worth a fair amount of cash. So, I mean, it's kind of nice that we see one being, you know, dropped irresponsibly for a change, just to, you know, remind everybody that these things do exist and they are getting weaponized and they do work.
So what exactly did this guy do?
So the bug is in the SCTP protocol stack, which is like the... What, stream reliable, a stream control trend, something like the stream control transition protocol, which is a not widely used network protocol. So it's not like it's going to affect every Linux box ever. But, you know, it is it's a good example when you read through his exploit of the kind of the level of detail required to exploit some of these bugs, but to prove that it is absolutely still doable as a result.
So this guy wrote an exploit?
Yeah, he wrote an exploit. And, you know, it's a nice exploit. It works well. Good for him.
Right.
But I think, yeah, primarily he's making a point that, you know, we need to not be convinced when vendors say denial of service.
Now, look, just in brief from CNET, very predictable bit of news. There's some phishing scams going around using swine flu as bait.
Yeah, well, you know, big surprise, huh?
Yeah, okay, next.
Yeah, exactly.
Adobe, you suck. True or false?
Hell, that's true, yes.
Please tell us more.
Yeah, no, I think Adobe maybe have a new Apple here, eh? You know, more security holes in Adobe Acrobat Reader. You know, big surprise. In this case, people have been recommended to disable JavaScript in their Acrobat Reader. Hang on a second, why do I need JavaScript in my PDF reader in the first place?
Mate, that's exactly what, when the last one of these came around, there was an exploit going around that used JavaScript to in some way in the exploit. I don't think it was like, I don't think you could actually disable the vulnerability by turning off JavaScript, but you could kill off the exploitability. And we had Paul Ducklin on the show who's like, yeah, said exactly the same thing as what you just said then. He's like, why the hell do you need JavaScript in your PDF reader?
Exactly.
No, but you think...
Is there JavaScript in my JPEG reader? No. Is there JavaScript in my PNG reader? No.
Yeah.
Why should there be JavaScript in my PDF reader?
I mean, what I don't get is how hard can it be to build a secure document reader?
Well, I mean, I'm sure Acrobat, you know, from 10 years ago probably wasn't so bad just because it isn't so bloated with goddamn features.
But why do we need this many features?
And feature bloat.
Yeah, but why? Why has Adobe done this to their reader? I mean, it was supposed to be a simple portable document format. That was the whole idea behind PDF. And now they've created this incredibly horrific piece of software that I stopped using about 5 years ago because I found it, probably not that long ago, but yeah, I did stop using it because I just found it incredibly bloaty. It was unreliable as hell. It was resource intensive. And as we're finding out now, it's hideously insecure.
Yeah, no, well, I agree with you. I don't know what the hell they're thinking. I guess it's just they have to keep innovating or they feel like they're going nowhere. You know, people are, you know, not going to buy their latest whiz-bang creative suite 5.5 extra whiz-bang deluxe hyper edition.
Hyper super global edition.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, look, to security managers listening out there, to chief security officers out there, do you reckon it's time to switch to another PDF reader?
Well, hopefully they're better than Adobe's, but... I don't know. I think really we just need to, you know, have a document format that doesn't get so bloated with features, and maybe the only way to do that is open standards.
That doesn't help our blokes in the meantime, Adam. You know, I mean,
no, well, but they're already screwed anyway, so you know.
But we're asking, you know, F-Secure has come out and categorically said, do not use Adobe.
Yeah, and I think that is good advice, and even if it's only because it makes people, you know, pundits like us talk up. The fact that they've said that, so people get a bit more awareness of it. Like, even if that's all it achieves, that's good. But no, I think in general, yes. If you don't need Acrobat Reader, you don't need all the whiz-bang features, then yeah, use a plain vanilla PDF reader.
Okay, well, there you go. You heard it. Now, Adam, as you know, I'm about to speak with the guy from Centrelink who helped to develop this new Plaid smart card authentication protocol. What do you think of the idea of a government sort of going out on a limb like this and trying to get its standard standardized, like accepted as an open standard?
Yeah, so it's multifaceted, really, isn't it? I mean, there's in some respects you have to kind of admire them for deciding that they're going to undertake such a project and going ahead and doing it, and hopefully doing a reasonable job. I mean, that's in government seems fairly unusual to take that much risk. So, I mean, props to them for doing it in the first place. On the other hand, you know, it makes me feel bad, right? Because really, do we want a government body developing cryptographic standards and smart cards, stuff like this sort of stuff is complex to get right. It needs good peer review. It needs, you know, solid, you know, PhD level academic support and research and analysis. And some of the stuff just takes years to shake the bugs out of.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Adam, because they've already been going on this thing for 3 years. They've given it to the Defense Signals Directorate, and they've also given it to NIST in the US, and both of them have given it a tick. Now, it's not using any new crypto. It's using all existing crypto standards that are tested. It's just a new auth protocol.
And it is... Well, exactly. And how badly could they get that wrong?
Well, it's... But the idea is now they're not looking to implement this anytime soon. They're actually trying to do this the right way. Now, you know, we'll get to the interview shortly, but I just wanted to hear your opinion on that. So you agree, though, that it is a risky proposition?
It is. I would say that it is risky business.
Oh, snap.
Ooh, look at that. Nice, huh? You see what I did there?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think I, you know, admire them for giving it a try, but fundamentally, I'm not sure whether they should be in the business of doing that. Although, on the other hand, leaving it to commercial smart card vendors is probably an even worse idea.
Yeah, this is the thing.
So, you know, my initial impression was, oh, God, this sounds like an awful idea. But having read a bit more about it, like the fact that they are attempting to make it into an open standard and they are getting it reviewed and opening it up, you know, for a kind of open source review, and that it has at least been past some people, it does sound like they have some vague idea of what they're doing and they are attempting somewhat to do it right. But, you know, I think, you know, if the Goodman were here, he would probably not have a smile on his face.
Well, we'll be hearing from Glenn Mitchell from Centrelink soon, and I guess, you know, straight from the horse's mouth, yay. And then you can, I guess, hopefully your concerns will be allayed, Adam. Now, before we go, you've actually discovered a bit of a tool that's released, what, about a week ago, called Conboot, that you think belongs in every single security guy's toolkit.
Yeah, definitely. This is it's one of these kind of really useful little tools that, yeah, as you say, everyone needs to have in their kit. It's a tool called Conboot by some kind of old school Polish virus coder by the look of things. Basically it does.
That's reassuring. Burn this ISO and put it in your computer.
Well, actually, no, it's basically a boot text image which will Trojan the Windows or Linux kernels on the fly during boot to remove the requirement for password authentication. Basically, you boot up off the CD, it boots whatever OS is on the hard disk, and then when you get to the auth prompt, you type in either a magic username in Linux or any username that's valid on the box and any password you like on Windows, and it logs you in. So in some respects, similar to some of the work that I did with Unlockpwn a couple of years back, but the same sort of thing, but during boot time, which is just really handy. It means you don't have to worry, mess about, you know...
with passwords and all those silly little things.
Resetting the passwords. Yeah, like pesky things like passwords you don't have to worry about.
Yeah, now for listeners, just before you continue, Adam, for listeners who aren't aware, Adam was actually the author of Unlockpwn, which was basically you could get a computer running Unlockpwn, plug it in via FireWire into a target system, and it would use the direct memory access feature in FireWire to basically patch over the code responsible for determining the screen pass if the screen password was correct on a Windows box. So you plug it in, you get you can pop open a Windows box. Basically, it was very cool stuff. Very cool stuff, Adam. So this is like that, but you don't need FireWire.
This is the same thing for boot time. So if you've got physical access to the box to boot off a CD or a floppy disk or a USB floppy image, then yeah, you can gain access to the machine without a password, assuming there's no encrypted disks or, you know, other impediments.
Yeah, like the fact that you can't boot off CD.
Like the fact that you can't boot off CD or floppy or USB.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, But I mean, really, you know, a physical access attack like that, you're going to win eventually, even if you have to pop the lid and pop the CMOS battery, you know, reset the BIOS password, stopping you from booting off CD. But yeah, obviously, you can't do those attacks in all circumstances. Yeah, but no, it's just a real handy tool for, you know, forensics guys and IT security guys, just to have in your toolkit. Because, I mean, often you need to get access to the machine and you don't have, you know, easy access to the credentials for. You know, it's just a handy thing, and I think everyone should probably have it in their toolkit, you know, along with, you know, BART PE and all the other, you know, Windows recovery tools that you have in your kit. And I think this is just, you know, another addition. And it works on, you know, XP and Vista and Windows 7, apparently. And took, you know, Server 2.3. So it, yeah, covers all the bases, does everything that you you will need from it, and you know, for a couple of sectors on a disk is well worth it.
All right, Adam. Well, we better get moving on, mate. We've got a big show this week, but thank you for stopping by and discussing the news with us.
Thanks very much, Pat. Till next time.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there, and a big thank you to Adam for being so generous with his time this week. Now it's time for this week's feature story. Now, here in Australia, we actually have a solid welfare system. It's run by a government department called Centrelink, which has around 26,000 employees, and they pay out everything from student allowances, pensions, to unemployment benefits. Centrelink is a big agency with a lot of employees. Now, it's also an agency that's been looking out to roll a new authentication system. It's proceeding with a rollout of some fairly standard PKI stuff on smart cards, but it's not entirely happy with what's out there already. So as you'll hear, Centrelink has actually spent several years working on its own smart card authentication protocol. What's that, I hear you say? They're insane. You never roll your own crypto. Well, I guess that's true, but Centrelink has actually released its draft implementation and plans to get the PLAID authentication protocol, as it's known, recognized as an ISO standard. So it's an extremely ambitious project, and there's already been, as I mentioned in the intro, around $560,000 of taxpayers' money spent on the project. Before we decided to pass judgment on this one, we thought it would be a good idea to speak to someone from the team that developed PLAID. Now, after a frantic ring around, we managed to line up an interview with Centrelink's smart card architect, Glenn Mitchell. And a big thanks to Simon Ferguson from Centrelink's media liaison office for making that happen, because he really did work pretty hard to get us this interview. And also thank you to Glenn Mitchell for giving up his time, because as you can imagine, with this making news, it's been a very busy week for him. Now, as you'll hear, the project isn't as half-assed and foolhardy as it originally appeared to be, you know, courtesy of some pretty shoddy reporting. So I started off by asking Glenn exactly what PLAID is and what it's designed to do.
Okay, the new protocol, which has been named PLAID, it's got two main functions. It's designed to allow authentication to system resources, whether it be logical or physical, and it has that in common with a lot of already existing solutions out there, such as PKI. The other aspect of PLAID, which is a little bit more unique to this protocol and some of our motivation behind inventing it, was that in the traffic going to and from the smart card, PLAID was designed to ensure that there was no static information that could be intercepted and captured, which would therefore allow the card and therefore the person to be identified. So it's more designed for privacy. Well, it's designed for privacy and security.
Okay, so basically there is no bit of information that passes in clear text that makes that particular card identifiable.
That's correct. For what we're issuing here at Centrelink, we use contactless smart cards. So there's a lot of traffic which is transmitted from the reader to the card, and then the card responds likewise through the airways. All of that traffic can very easily be passively picked up and decoded, and possibly if it has static information or any sort of determinable information, could then be used to identify the card holder. PLAID was designed to ensure that all the air traffic is sufficiently scrambled so that there's no way to identify the card involved in the transaction and therefore the person.
So are you saying that there's not a single implementation out there, a single standard implementation that is capable of doing that?
Not that we're aware of. The main other authentication protocols, they've got the PKI, which is the high security certificate-based authentication. The general steps involved in PKI is for a card to transmit its public certificate, which has got unique identifiers, therefore it's a unique per transaction. which brings us back to why we thought it was a privacy concern. Other authentication protocols, such as those used in Secure Channel Protocol 1, 2, and the like, they are based on symmetric ciphers which require unique information per card to be passed back to allow key diversification to take place. So both those two classes of authentication require static information to be transmitted. Play doesn't have any of those type of requirements to perform an authentication.
Okay, so who actually was the person who came up with the idea to write this new protocol, and how did it sort of come to be? I mean, who signed off on it?
Well, the authentication protocol was started, I believe, originally back in 2006 or 7. Centrelink originally had no intentions of creating a new protocol, so the team here did a bit of research to see what options were out there which would meet Centrelink's business need. There's quite a few PKI solutions based on the contact interface, which other, or at least one other government department had issued, but they weren't directly applicable to Centrelink's business needs. What I mean by that is the Centrelink offices, the customer service centres, are generally open plan, a little bit like a cafe where there's no clear demarcation between where the staff can go and where the customers can go. With that in mind, it wasn't appropriate to use a contact-based authentication protocol because that would require a staff member to debadge themselves, in which case the card could get lost, stolen, or misplaced in some other way. We examined a few other authentication solutions which were currently out there deployed, such as, say, the MyFair solution, which has since been shown to be insecure. So there was nothing out on the market that matched Centrelink's business needs that could be done quick enough to allow the transaction to take place.
I believe it was only some of the MyFair technology that was found to be flawed. There were some of the newer models with more advanced ciphers and whatnot that seemed to be okay. Did you look at them? Well,
when we started, there was... The newer modules in the MyFair family, the DesFire and the like, they use open standard cryptography, which was one of the flaws in the original type of solution. We did look at that, but the other angle, we also wanted to make sure that any solution that was procured by the government could be open, could be available from multiple vendors. In general, as far as I was aware, MyFair was produced by NXP, which is only available from one company. That being said, a lot of smart cards out there do have MyFair emulators located in the mask.
So there was a team assembled to look into basically rolling out a new and improved authentication system. So at what point was it decided? I understand the budget, this project to date has cost around $560,000, is that correct?
I believe that's correct, yes.
So was that the budget originally signed to the project? Was that the plan from the beginning?
No, that figure of 500-odd thousand, that's come from monies identified, which has been directly involved in the development of Plaid. There's a larger project here at Centrelink called the CSIC, which is the Centrelink Staff Identification Card Project, which is about replacing the existing way which staff members get access to system resources. That's got a much larger budget. The $500,000 was only what has been identified as being directly related to the development of Plaid so far. Centrelink has a need at the moment to replace its existing authentication system because it's based on a one-time password generator. So Centrelink, some stage this year, is going to be launching a dual interface PKI-based solution onto a smart card. Plaid was developed in parallel because the PKI solution didn't meet all the privacy requirements that we felt were desirable in an authentication solution. So the cards which are being launched this year for staff, once Plaid is mature enough, will be deployed on the smart cards that we're releasing to staff this year.
Okay, so Plaid is basically going to be step two.
Effectively, it's the next phase to authenticate staff to system resources. The first phase is based on a commercial off-the-shelf PKI-based solution.
And that's yet to roll out, is that correct?
That's yet to roll out. We're planning on rolling that out this year.
Okay, so what would a vendor out there need to actually do to implement your draft standard? Would that be quite difficult for them, or would it be quite easy?
Well, we're hoping it's going to be quite easy. On the GovDex website... As you've identified, we've spent $500,000 on the development of this, and part of that cost was around the proof of concepts and the generations of some prototypes. A lot of the software that came out of those phases has actually been uploaded to the GovDex website. Some things along those lines, which is up there, is in addition to the specification, which goes through the plate cipher in detail, there's also the Java card source code, which is the code which runs inside the smart card chip. A compiled version of that code is also on the website, as is the corresponding off-card code, which you can install on a PC and use that to interact with a plate-based smart card. All of those aspects were uploaded, and the specs have been published and publicized with the idea of making it easier for vendors, if they so choose, to incorporate plate into their product suites.
So you're really hoping that this actually becomes a standard in its own right, that both, you know, private organizations and public organizations will be able to go to smart card vendors and say, yes, we'd like the plate solution.
That's exactly right. There's nothing proprietary about this solution. We are in the process of standardizing it through more formal recognized bodies at the moment. There is, in the specification which is uploaded on GovDex, it does talk about the intellectual property, and it even states that it's available for everyone to use in a perpetual, irrevocable, worldwide, non-exclusive, royalty-free, and no-charge license. So the idea behind clauses like that are that vendors can safely incorporate it into their products without any fear that the government could ever lay claim to it at a later date.
Yeah. In case Hugo Chavez becomes the next Australian Prime Minister and decides it's time to get some royalty checks.
Yeah, that's the type of thing we're definitely trying to avoid, anyone trying to claim any royalties over this. It was developed by the Commonwealth of Australia through Senlink, and we wanted to see it as widely used as possible.
So how many people were involved in the actual development of this thing?
Well, it's been going for about 2.5 years now, so as you can imagine, people have come and gone. There's been two major project managers that were involved with the development of this standard, and the actual cryptographic exchange, there was two people that actually determined how to make Plaid work in a practical and speedy way.
So it's been a fairly small team.
It's been a fairly small team, which has been working on Plaid, but Centrelink doesn't really have the mandate to develop cryptographic protocols. So it's been teams that have been involved with other projects that have provided expertise to this one, mainly within the Security and Information Protection branch.
Okay. Now, look, I know from the material that's been released that Plaid has apparently been reviewed and given the tick by both the Defence Signals Directorate and NIST in the US, which is quite interesting. But, you know, the general consensus out there is that rolling your own crypto is not the done thing. I mean, what's your response to that? People say you just never roll your own, and here you guys are rolling your own.
I completely agree. Rolling your own crypto is definitely not the done thing. History has shown us with algorithms such as the Crypto1 cipher that rolling your own crypto is always a bad idea. Basically, any cryptographic algorithm which is put out in the public or which is supposed to be used for high security applications needs to be open, and it needs to be reviewed by the wider cryptographic community. When it came to Plaid, it's probably an important distinction. Plaid isn't a cryptographic algorithm. It's a protocol. Plaid, underneath the bonnet, uses two cryptographic algorithms, the first one being the RSA cipher, the second one being the Rheindahl cipher, which is standardized by the AES standard, FIPS 197, I believe. So the actual cryptographic exchange to do a Plaid authentication is based on two well-established, well-reviewed and considered secure algorithms which have been launched and approved by DSD and many other governments around the world.
But that's not to say that this is guaranteed to be trouble-free, is it?
No, it's definitely not to say that there may be issues, and that's part of the exercise that we're doing now in socialising and publicising it. If anyone does find any issues with it, then we're more than happy to take feedback on board and see what we can do to review it. That's generally how cryptographic protocols and algorithms get better.
Do you actually have a budget for external testing?
Not that I'm aware of. That would probably be a question for the project manager.
Okay, or the minister.
Possibly.
The minister's been very excited about this, putting out press releases saying, yay us, we've just saved the world from hackers.
Yeah, there's been a significant response, but the benefit around Plaid for me is that it was actually developed in the right order for an IT-based project, whereas all the business needs were examined and evaluated, and then a technology was applied to match the exact business need for Centrelink.
What's the response been like from vendors? I imagine you've had every single smart card vendor under the sun ringing you up saying, why don't you use our solution? It'll do everything you need.
We have had a few vendors call up and query what we're trying to do. Obviously, there's some commercial interest involved with vendors that have existing products.
But no interest as yet in incorporating the draft standard or looking at incorporating the draft standard into existing products?
Well, unfortunately, I believe that most vendors won't seriously contemplate a cryptographic protocol until it does become a standard, which is why at the moment the Plaid development team is in talks with Standards Australia to get Plaid as a recognised Australian standard, and then from there possibly to an ISO standard. We're also looking at other smart card type standardisation bodies to see if we can get Plaid formalised and recognised through them as well. Once it is standardised, which of course implies a lot of the IP issues have been resolved or at least articulated as well, then we expect to see a little bit more enthusiasm from the vendor community to incorporate Plaid into their products.
So what's your timeline really for seeing this thing actually up and running?
Ideally, we'd like to get it out sometime next year. But as you've stated, there's been a fair bit of airplay in the media on this exact topic. So our point of view at the moment is it's now been publicised. We're going to be receiving a lot of feedback. We need to take a lot of that on board. I'm sure some of the ideas will have a lot of merit. We basically need to make sure that it is as secure as we believe it to be. And if there are any improvements to it, then we'll take those on board as well.
Okay, so I guess you'd be encouraging anyone out there with the skills to really download that draft standard and rip into it.
Absolutely.
Go for it.
Yep.
All right. Now, I understand, too, the budget for the final rollout, that's in the order of $10 million to 26,000 users, is that correct?
That's for the entire CSIC project, which is the Centrelink staff identification card. Like I said before, the first phase of the CSIC project is to issue staff cards based on PKI authentication. So the lion's share of that $10 million is around things like the actual cost of the smart card, holograms, high security modules, software to make it work.
And so really you're going to be doing like more of a software upgrade after that, which will see Plaid rolled out. Is that correct?
That's correct. When we decided to take the lower risk option and issue PKI-based smart cards initially, we made sure that the smart cards that we procured were capable of running Plaid authentication, which will basically allow us to reissue the cards without actually having to get the cards back and physically reissue to the users.
How will that process work?
Well, when the cards arrive at this, for the first phase with the PKI solution, when the cards arrive, an authorised Access Link officer will place the card into a reader and basically mint the credentials on a PKI-based authentication scheme. When Plaid's ready to be rolled out, these cards will also be able to be taken back to the local Access Link officer, and the PKI applet will be removed and a Plaid applet instantiated.
This CSIC rollout, though, this is also a contactless solution. Is that correct?
The PKI solution we've got is a dual interface card.
Oh, okay. So it's got both.
It's got a single chip, but the communication mediums can be through either 1443 contactless or the contact plate.
I've got to ask too, did you have a look at the Common Access Card standard from the United States DoD? I mean, is that something that's actually public or...?
Yeah, well, Common Access Card is a little bit old now. We've looked at FIPS 201, which describes the PIV card. We've been in contact, as you've identified earlier, we've been in contact with NIST over there. We've had a look at a lot of the merits of the PIV card, and when it comes to rolling out Plaid as an identity management solution, noting that at this stage it's simply a protocol for authentication, it's not a complete solution, there may be some aspects of other precedents such as PIV, such as the Australian image, that we may incorporate. Although when it comes to PIV, there are some aspects which are not as acceptable in Australia as they may be in other countries, such as biometric templates and fingerprints.
So how did you actually wind up getting NIST to look at this thing, and how deeply did they look at it? That goes for the DSD as well.
We, being Centrelink, commissioned DSD to do an evaluation of an earlier version of Plaid back in 2006, I believe it was. So basically we provided them with all the information of an earlier version of Plaid. We asked them to provide an opinion and suggest any improvements to it, and they formalised a report which was sent back to Centrelink, basically noting a few minor improvements, but overall suggesting that it was secure.
Okay, and as for NIST?
I probably don't really want to comment on our interaction with any foreign governments at this stage.
Okay, no problem. Well, look, this sounds like a tremendously ambitious project, Glenn, and we wish you all the best. Thanks for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business.
Thank you very much.
Glenn Mitchell on the line from Canberra. On to this week's sponsor interview now, and as you know, Risky Business has four sponsors who make the show worth doing. God bless them. And this week's sponsor is Tenable Network Security. Tenable, they're a really worthwhile company and they've got a lot of great people working for them. I know many of them. And look, as part of this sponsorship agreement with Risky Business, we get one of their people on the show every 4 weeks for a chat about recent events. This week, we're speaking with a bit of a legend, Marcus Renham. Marcus joined us to discuss recent reports that several terabytes of data pertaining to the design of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter had gone walkies over the wire. I started off by asking Marcus if he thought the reports were plain and simple bullshit.
Well, I don't know exactly if I'd call it bullshit. It certainly does sound like some data may have been lost, tens of terabytes, as they say. It just, it's a little suspicious, you know. There's all this stuff about the Chinese spies, and then we get the Chinese and Russian spies in the power grid, and now we've got this, and then... The particular article that I saw about the JSF leak that kind of concluded with some completely weird irrelevancies from the same guy about how, you know, and this could result in getting into air traffic control systems, which makes me wonder if the guy even has a clue what he's talking about. And, you know, all of this sounds like it's just a drumbeat to you know, let's just get the taxpayers to open up their wallets and fork over hundreds of millions of dollars to fix things that should have been built right in the first place.
Well, Marcus, I don't think it's necessarily just a case of, hey, taxpayers, throw open your wallets. I think it's a case of, hey, taxpayers, throw open your wallets and give the money to our government department. There seems to be scaremongering coming out of various camps within the U.S. defense establishment, everyone from the Department of Homeland Security over to the NSA sort of seems to have a different opinion of who should be the recipient of the almighty government dollar.
Oh, yeah, well, these guys have always disagreed about who should, you know, have control over cybersecurity. I actually wrote some stuff about that in my book back in 2002. You know, you got different agencies, and they all want the coveted ball of being the cybersecurity czar, yet none of them actually have the ability to carry that role forward. Although, you know, I do have to say some of them have been working on building that ability, whereas others have simply been hiring outsourcers to build that ability for them. So, I think a lot of this is kind of interagency bickering.
Posturing, if you will.
I had to fumble there to come up with a nice word for it.
So, is it specifically the terabytes, the multiple terabytes of data that were allegedly stolen from Lockheed Martin or whoever it was that made you suspicious immediately? Because I've got to admit that when I read that, I thought, you know what, I think even the most incompetent sort of security admin would notice a few terabytes creeping out of the network, and you'd think a defense contractor would probably have some fairly competent people on staff who would tend to notice something like that.
You would hope. You would even expect that the users would complain that their, you know, their internet porn surfing was slow for a couple of days or something like that. But you know, that's another piece of this story that waves some big red flags at me, because, you know, in principle, this kind of material I would imagine would be classified, and in theory, networks that are holding classified material are connected to the internet at least through cross-domain solutions that are primarily one-way only.
You're thinking like 10X's data diode, you know, EAL 6000 certified sort of thing.
Yeah, something like that. Well, there's these things that the government has that they call cross-domain solutions. And a cross-domain solution is kind of like a firewall, except it costs a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Yeah.
but basically, it does all the same stuff that a firewall does, except it's got, you know, extra super duper fairy dust sprinkled on it. And there's about 250 different kinds of cross domain solutions that have been certified for different purposes, for different agencies, for different uses under different circumstances. And you know, all this stuff sounds, you know, fairly plausible. And I'm sure that if it's done right, it can be done right. But if we're talking tens of terabytes of data leaking out through something like that, that sounds kind of silly, especially since, you know, the folks that I know who've done cross-domain solutions, we're talking in the hundreds of kilobytes per second range. As high-speed cross-domain solutions. We're not talking gigabit speed going on here, you know. Or the other alternative is some contractor walked out of some place with a bunch of terabyte drives stuck under his coat. You know, it'll be what about 20 or so of those Seagate 1.5 terabyte drives, maybe?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they're doing amazing things with miniaturization these days, Marcus. Perhaps someone walked out wearing it, shall we say, internally.
It's completely possible, but, you know, I mean, this all just sounds really silly to me. I mean, it simply sounds more like if the data leaked out, and we're talking about this much data, that there was somebody on the inside who was supplementing his government or contractor paycheck with a little bit of money from someplace else. And, you know, I've written about this elsewhere. You know, espionage is espionage, and the internet only changes the landscape of espionage if you're a complete fool, right? If you're somebody who thinks that, you know, the internet is not going to somehow be used for espionage, you're a complete fool. You know, and apparently we've got some of those in Washington, but the fact that the internet is available there as a tool for spies, it doesn't change the fact that spies have always had ways of getting data back and forth, and that the internet is maybe only just one of them. I mean, I could envision all kinds of crazy scenarios where, you know, somebody sneaks out with a couple of dats in their briefcase every day for some number of months, and they're all, you know, encrypted to something or other with some key, and then they get dumped in a dumpster someplace and picked up and decrypted based on a key that's posted to Craigslist.
Did it occur to you that it's a slightly strange thing? I mean, did you see the story about computer spies breaching the electricity grid?
Yeah, that's another one that's really interesting.
Now, what's interesting is that appeared 2 weeks before this one about the Joint Strike Fighter, the alleged breach of the Joint Strike Fighter stuff. Same journalist, same paper.
Oh, really? I hadn't noticed it was the same journalist. What's going on here?
Siobhan Gorman from the Wall Street Journal, and I suspect she's either got some sources blowing some serious misinformation her way. I mean, this is just my suspicion. She might be the greatest, you know, Scoop Master 2000 we've ever seen, but I just think she's being fed a line of bullshit from someone.
Right. And, you know, the CIA and FBI and the other government agencies have made no bones about the fact that in the past they have selectively shuffled information to journalists to make them look more competent or to make their competitors look less competent. This happens all the time. I think, you know, the other question that's really interesting is if this information was true, presumably it would be classified information as well. So, you know, we saw Congress getting its panties in a major bunch over leaking out the Valerie Plame story, which was classified, you know, and here we're talking about a $300 billion program getting compromised, and what, that fact isn't classified?
Yeah, I mean, I do think this is a very strange little saga, but it boils down to a much broader problem in the information security world, I think, Marcus, which is that really, we can't trust anyone with statistics in this industry, because everyone who's in a position to collect statistics has something to gain by manipulating those statistics.
Right. Well, this has been, you know, consistently has been one of my beefs against the whole notion of risk management, too. You know, that this game's being played by everybody in the security community. People manipulate the statistics in order to get us to do what they think we ought to do. We manipulate the statistics that we give our bosses in order to get them to give us money to buy a new firewall. You know, and nobody actually has any basis for any of this stuff that's defensible. It's really a travesty in a lot of ways.
So what do we do apart from not believe anything the government tells us?
Well, I don't believe anything anybody tells me at this point. I think you really need to verify a great deal. And with things like these claims about the espionage stuff, the first thing you need to do when somebody spouts this stuff off is say, where did you get that information? And if you got that information, if you actually knew this stuff, how are you actually cleared to be able to talk about it? And what'll always come back when you challenge somebody like that is they'll come back and they'll say, well, a friend of a friend told me, or my cousin's uncle's nephew's hair, barber told him, and he works for some agency that we can't, That's just the most absurd trope I've ever heard, and you hear it every place. And I even hear it from, respected people in the industry. I call foul on some of this stuff, and I get back the, well, if you knew what I knew, kind of nonsense. And the answer is, if you knew what you think you know, you wouldn't have been able to say what you just said. So I know that you don't know anything.
Well, I mean, these stories have both been written up as if someone has given not an off the record or a not for attribution briefing, which is quite common. I mean, certainly people who know things that are classified will tell journalists on occasion, and it's not against the law for the journalist to then report that information.
Sure, and that's totally true. I mean, somebody leaked out some more classified information. So the score for this one would be $300 billion Joint Strike Fighter plus the secret about its having leaked out. I mean, as a taxpayer, the thing about this that really annoys me is first off, it's a good question as to whether any other country in the world is going to be stupid enough to try to build one of those things.
Well, we're buying them from you guys, but I mean, as I suggested on last week's show, if China really do have the plans for the Joint Strike Fighter, I'm hoping they're going to start making some cheap knockoffs and we can just buy them from China.
Exactly. And I hope that, we at least as a taxpayer, I hope that at least that we can, kind of recover some of that in a copyright lawsuit or something and say, hey, that's our copyrighted super fighter jet that you stole.
You guys will need to have, you'll need to get the CIA together with the Recording Industry Association, mate, so that they can discuss their tactics.
Geez, yeah, I wonder if anybody, I've got some friends who are really into downloading stuff. Maybe I can get them to look and see if there's any Joint Strike Fighter plans available for download on any of the torrents. I mean, but this is really just laughable. And anyone who understands information security understands that, the properties of a secret is that the more people who have their hands on it, the less likely it is to stay secret. And the more your data gets moved around, the less likely it is to not get disclosed, right? So if you've got something like this that's being made with massive involvement from contractors all over the place and lots of people are touching it, one of them's going to supplement their income. And saying it's a cyber attack is ridiculously silly.
Might have liked it before, it was something more. Can't look back, see, I'm always looking forward. Just a setback, it's not the end. I keep on pushing, bitch, I got great friends.
Marcus Ranham on the line from the USA there. Now, before we go, we've got some housekeeping matters. If you haven't already done so, you should unsubscribe from our old itradio.com.au RSS feed and resubscribe to our new feed at risky.biz/feeds. The old one's going dark soon, so you've been given fair warning. We're wrapping up our sign-ups competition in a few weeks, probably the week after the AusCert conference, because we're going to be pretty frantic until then. So we've got an EPC, courtesy of Kaspersky, to give away, as well as some TikiTag RFID reader and writers, and some little toolkits, courtesy of Microsoft, and a big thank you to all who supplied those prizes. To win, all you need to do is go to risky.biz and sign up for an account. Now, in order to stay compliant with Australian regulations, we can't offer prizes based on a game of chance. So instead of drawing the usernames out of a hat, printing them out and chopping them up and putting them in a hat, we'll be letting my mate's toddler pick the winners, whatever username they think is the coolest. Now it's a game of skill and we're compliant, and there's no way that we'll actually be doing a random draw. Yeah. So to be eligible, you must be in Australia or New Zealand and fill in all of the form data correctly. So we need your job title and, where you work and all that sort of stuff. Other things to mention, I also wanted to mention the ISLA awards being run by ISE Squared. They're the same guys who do the CISP certifications. There are awards for Best Non-IT Security Professional, Best IT Security Pro, and Best Security Practitioner. Go to isc2.org/ISLA for more information. Also, a listener of ours has organised a bit of an anti-censorship campaign, and there's some video he's put online that he recorded at RSA. Dan Kaminsky's in there, and just by coincidence, Marcus Ranham, who we just heard from. You can find that at NodeCity, N-O-D-E-C-I-T-Y, nodecity.com/empower, E-M-P-O-W-E-R. We'd also like to hear your thoughts on Plaid. Do you think it's a waste of time and taxpayer money, or do you think it's a masterstroke and the sort of initiative you'd like to see other governments around the world engaging in? Call our voicemail box in Sydney, 02-8569-1835, or call us toll-free in the USA on 877-688-8417. Or you can just go to risky.biz and jump into the forums. And, of course, we'll play any audio we get in next week's show. This week's track is called Something Better by Marshall and the Fro, and you can buy the album from marshallmusic.com.au. So come on, support some indie music. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Dance in the desert, but dance in the street. Music shows your feet. Kids and thongs and beers and chong. People who talk and all get along. I felt you before, but I'm not so sure. I can't look back, said I'm always looking forward. You can bank your money till the cows come home, or free some mates from the bills they owe. It's just a setback, it's not the end. Keep on pushing, but you got great friends. So save it for something better. Save it for something better. Save it for something better. Gonna come from this, I know. Save it for something better. Save it for something better. Save it for something better. Gonna come from this, I know. Here we try from what is left. We're not a matter for your second guess. We can make you grin, how's that a sin? Don't squint your eyes from the glare, my friend. I know what I want, only after I don't. Like there's times when we used to smoke. I think to myself that I should be safe, but then I turn to her and say it wasn't me. Striving for something better. Striving for something better. Striving for something better. Gonna come from this, I know. Striving for something better. Striving for something better. Striving for something better. Gonna come from this, I know.
Something better, save it for something better, save it for.